Here's a special offer for Issues Etc. listeners. For any size gift during the Easter season, we'll send you a recording of an Ascension and Pentecost sermon preached by Pastor Todd Wilkin. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. Issues Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. And for any size gift between Easter Sunday and Pentecost Sunday, May 19th, we'll send you a CD of one of Todd's Ascension and Pentecost sermons. Now, when you make your gift, please indicate whether you want a downloadable version or a CD of these sermons. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the Easter season.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I guess some compromise is inevitable. The pressure of the culture is so strong on the church, especially the American church. The failure to distinguish between cultural mores as they change, and they do inevitably change, and a stated Christian position is one that's, well, I don't know if that skill is still common in American evangelicalism. And it's not unusual to hear evangelical teachers, evangelical preachers talk about issues like divorce or not talk about issues like divorce. They do not consider what Scripture has to say about it particularly noteworthy, particularly remarkable, and when they do talk about it, it seems as though they want to say that Jesus and the apostles, well, didn't make that big of a deal out of divorce. Have we been wrong all along? There's also an argument that we're going to have Dr. Robert Gagnon respond to here in the last half hour that you probably have heard, and that is that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in the Genesis account may be about homosexuality in some sense, maybe a very deviant form of homosexuality, but not about homosexuality per se. It's Thursday afternoon, April the 4th. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about these issues, Dr. Robert Gagnon. He's a regular guest, associate professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, author of the book The Bible and Homosexual Practice, Texts and Hermeneutics. Dr. Gagnon, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
The first thing I wanted to talk to you about is, and you've responded to it some time back, but the kind of the evangelical compromise that is underway on the issue of divorce. How would you summarize the current, and we're talking here about scholarly thinking among evangelicals, the current scholarly thinking on the biblical view of divorce?
Well, there are different viewpoints. I think one that's been gaining some ground is a position that had been put out by David Instone Brewer, who's a good solid Christian. He's from England, does a lot of work with early Jewish studies in relation and its intersection with Christianity. And he published a book on divorce and remarriage in the New Testament, which basically, it's kind of difficult to describe because he's moved a little bit on the issue, but essentially he says that you can get divorced if on not only grounds of adultery, but other grounds as well, including lack of conjugal rights and insufficient providing materially for the spouse. And in the end, I think he actually moves to, although he rejects the view that Jesus allowed for divorce for any matter, in the end, since he says you can't really investigate why a person gets a divorce, you really have to grant it all.
So what's at stake in this view that seems to be gaining some in evangelical circles?
Well, I think what is at stake is a loss of the vision that Jesus had for sexual purity, for longevity, for the indissoluble character of marriage. Basically, Jesus took, in my view, looking at the text that we see in Mark 10, parallel to Matthew 19, the Sermon on the Mount discussion in Matthew 5, or the parallel in Luke 16, when you look at these texts, Jesus is basically taking the hardest case known to us, and that would be taking the case of a woman invalidly divorced, and arguing even in those cases, if that woman remarries, she commits adultery, and if a man attempts to marry her, he commits adultery. And so it's really a very hard saying, to be sure. But what's interesting about it is that to say it, Jesus had to buck the entire culture around him, which was much more permissive on that question.
Now, talk a bit about that, if you would. It's often, people have often put forth an idea that Jesus was revolutionary in the other direction, in kind of the permissive nature of what he would allow. But you're saying that the culture to which he is speaking is actually the more permissive. How would you describe it?
Well, yes, exactly like that. I mean, Jesus, when it comes to sexual ethics, we find Jesus becoming more aggressive in limiting the options that are available. Basically, for Jesus, the only option available is sex with one person for life in a marital bond. And that's it. And everything else he seems to be opposed to. So he's far more stringent than what we find prevailing in the culture generally, not only in the Greco-Roman world, outside Judaism, but within Judaism itself. In Judaism, you had options between one Pharisaic school of thought, the House of Hillel, which basically allowed divorce for men, never for women. Women weren't given that right as an initiative on any matter. And the House of Shammai basically allowed it on grounds of adultery. And then there's some question about whether or not some additional grounds, like the question of lack of material provision. But basically, it was understood as allowed. And even beyond that, of course, men also had the right of multiple wives. Effectively, what Jesus did is he closed out both options by appealing to the Genesis creation text. And he said, you see that foundational two-ness of the sexes that God established at creation? Male and female, he made them. Genesis 1:27 and Genesis 2:24. For this reason, a man may become joined to a woman, and the two become one flesh. That two-ness of the sexes is your clue, Jesus said, that God only wants two persons in a sexual union, whether at any one time or serially. So rejecting a revolving door of divorce or remarriage, and rejecting concurrent polygamy.
Is it safe to say that with respect to divorce, Jesus holds practically an ideal position with respect to marriage and divorce?
If I think we mean by ideal that he didn't actually expect his followers to carry it through, then I would say no. If we mean by ideal that which he regards as incumbent on his followers, then I think the answer is yes. I think Jesus actually meant what he said, in other words. Now, then the question arises of what would we do if a follower of Jesus, what would Jesus have done if a follower of his said, well, okay, I've heard what you said. I know you don't want me to do it. I'm going to do it anyway. Or the more difficult case of a woman who has been invalidly divorced, you know, this man wants to marry me now. I need to in this sort of a culture. What would Jesus say to that? Or more to the point, what would he say after the fact when a remarriage after divorce took place? And I guess that's a little bit more dicey to figure out. I think it's fairly clear that he would say, I'm telling you not to do it. But then after they do it, then what would he do?
Well, perhaps maybe some light can be shed upon that, an answer to that question, by just briefly discussing what St. Paul had to say. He also speaks about divorce and does a little casuistry for Christians on the issue of marriage and divorce. First of all, is there any light between Jesus' teaching and St. Paul's teaching on marriage and divorce?
Well, Paul gives two options, basically, for divorce. Oh, he gives one option, actually, but we presume Matthew's account. Matthew gives the exception clause, except on grounds of sexual immorality, porneia. Although Matthew doesn't speak to the question of remarriage, just the dissolution of the union. In Paul's case, in 1 Corinthians 7, of course, we have the added point that if you're married to an unbeliever and the unbeliever insists on leaving, then it's okay to let them leave. And otherwise, Paul talks at the beginning of the chapter about a woman should remain, if a person, a woman should not divorce or be let go of her husband or his language is separate, should not separate from her husband. But if she does so, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to reconciled back again to her husband, her original husband. Those are the options, only options that he seems to give, I think, in that text.
Does he speak at all to the issue of remarriage after the divorce?
Well, that's the question. I think as far as dissolving the union to begin with, I think he only gives those two grounds. And then the question would be, okay, if you satisfy, actually not even two grounds, but we presume he will also accept the issue of adultery, then the question comes up about what about remarriage after those circumstances. And that's a little bit more doubtful. He makes a remark about we're not enslaved in certain circumstances. And some read into that based on divorce certificates in early Judaism, that would mean automatically that they also have the option to remarry. But that is less clear in the context in Paul's view. And the reason why I say that is because at Corinth, the issue that Paul is facing is that they actually want to dissolve their marital bonds, and they want to be celibate, so dissolving current engagements and dissolving current marital bonds, and thereafter be celibate. And so it's not at all clear in that circumstance whether Paul would be recommending, would be allowing for remarriage in those circumstances.
With only about a minute here before we take our first break, Dr. Gagnon, just a matter of your opinion, if you would. Has the evangelical compromise on the issue of divorce and remarriage, either in its scholarly form or in just the way it is actually practiced at the congregation level, has it advanced to the point of, well, kind of being beyond reform with respect to returning to what the Bible actually says about this? About a minute for your response.
Definitely, the Christian culture has departed generally from the teaching of Jesus. And that is because we've moved into a cultural context where sexual intercourse has become a right, even within, not R-I-T-E, R-I-G-H-T, even within the Christian communion.
Well, we'll pick up there on the other side of the break. Dr. Robert Gagnon is our guest. One more question on divorce, and then we're going to move on to the argument often made about the Sodom and Gomorrah story in the book of Genesis, saying that it may condemn some kind of homosexuality, but not homosexuality in general. We'll be right back. What are the similarities between the founders of Islam and Mormonism? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is The American Muhammad, Joseph Smith, Founder of Mormonism. It's written by regular guest Dr. Alvin Schmidt. You can purchase The American Muhammad by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, or you can find out more at issuesetc.org. The American Muhammad, The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. So visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastor to hold a seminar in your area. Just go to theclcc.org.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Redeemer Lutheran, Mandeville, Louisiana. Our Savior Lutheran, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin. Christ Lutheran, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Emmanuel Lutheran, Louisville, Nebraska. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania. Trinity Lutheran, Valonia, Indiana. Emmanuel Lutheran, Pensacola, Florida. St. Athanasius Lutheran, Vienna, Virginia. And Emmaus Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Robert Gagnon is our guest. He's Associate Professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary and author of the book The Bible and Homosexual Practice, Texts and Hermeneutics. One more question, kind of letting you finish your thought there on the issue of how far advanced the compromise in American evangelicalism is on the issue of divorce and remarriage. Do you consider it beyond reform?
You mean, can we ever go back to an earlier time when Christian culture took marriage more seriously?
Well, I mean, the you spoke before the break about how the culture has advanced to a point with regard to sexual intercourse. Do you think that evangelicalism will follow that advance or will turn back?
Already has followed that advance. It's already happened and continuing to happen. It'll even be more so. And the greatest reason for that is, I think, pastors are not doing their job preaching about sexual ethics in the pulpit on a regular basis. Partly that's because, well, you have children in the audience. You want to be careful what you say. But there are ways of getting around that. You can either have a special time where you're going to talk about it, even on a Sunday morning service, and say, in this service, we're going to provide some alternative location and stuff to do for the children. Or you can do it in Sunday school classes for adults or various other ways of doing it. But that the church is still going to be the primary influence on the issue of sexual ethics and culture. Lord knows that we're not going to get that from a secular culture. The only place it's going to come is from the pulpit, from pastors, from elders that are doing their job with regard to discussing this issue. And until pastors and evangelical communions begin to do this on a more regular basis and understand the significance that sexual purity has in Scripture for a life of discipleship in relation to Jesus as Lord, it's not going to happen.
Let's turn to the subject, and I think you have addressed this many times. I'm sure that in the course of not only interviews like this, but public debate, you've also heard the argument, and it has to do with the famous account in the book of Genesis of Sodom and Gomorrah. The argument is often made by proponents of homosexuality, especially those proponents of homosexuality within the church. They will say, look, that story does condemn something. It is intended to condemn something with respect to homosexuality, but not homosexuality itself, not homosexuality per se. What is the essence of this argument? Why is it being made?
Well, they want to argue that the Sodom story only indicts coercive forms of same-sex practice, and as a result, it has no application for as they put it, loving, committed same-sex sexual unions. So we should dismiss this text. And this dismissive approach to this text, I might add, is not only found in liberal circles, but even quite frequently in more moderate to conservative theological circles.
So what precisely do they think it does condemn?
They think it condemns inhospitality taking a form, the form of homosexual, of same-sex, not homosexual, I would just say same-sex rape. So what we have going on in this story is we have visitors coming to the town of Sodom. There are no hotels in antiquity at this time in the ancient Near East. You're pretty much expected that you're going to show up at the city gate, and people will take you into their homes and provide the necessary protection for you as a visitor. And that's what they mean by hospitality. And in this case, what happens is that these visitors are subjected to attempts by outsiders to rape them. These men, the men of Sodom, have no particular same-sex attractions. They just want to humiliate the visitors.
Is that borne out by the actual narrative?
Well, there are parts of it that are and parts of it that aren't. I don't think the narrative doesn't really specify whether or not some people thought they were going to have a little bit of a thrill here by having sex with persons of the same sex. And ultimately, the text doesn't care about that. To me, it's like talking about a story about a man raping his father or mother or sister, and then arguing that the only form of incest that this story is indicting is a coercive, violent form of incest. Nobody in our cultural context would understand a story being told in that light. They would understand the incest as being a compounding offense to the story, and not merely incidental to it. And so they would say, oh, well, this is a really bad case of rape. It's not only rape, generically speaking, but it's rape compounded by incest. So it's a really bad, heinous offense. And I think that's what's actually happening in the Sodom story. When it's read in its cultural context and in its literary context within the Bible, it's very clear that this is intended to convey a really bad offense that not only involves rape of visitors, an inhospitable act, to be sure, of the most extreme sort, but it also is a compounding offense because it's a same-sex offense as well, which further degrades or dishonors the visitors by treating their gender as if it were non-existent.
Give us an overview, if you would, of how that story is treated elsewhere in the Bible and what that information tells us.
Well, there's lots of other pieces of information to look at here that helps us to understand the meaning of the story. There is Ham's offense against his father Noah in Genesis 9, and I've argued that the seeing the nakedness of his father means more than just a visual thing. It's as the same phrase appearing in Leviticus 20 indicates, it has to do with sexual intercourse. It's a similar kind of rape to humiliate kind of act and to have authority over his father, in this case, supplant his father as the chief authoritative figure within the family unit at this point. Now, nobody, again, would argue, as I pointed out with regard to the incest parallel, that this story is only intended to indict forms of sex with your parent that are coercive. It's quite clear that incest per se is also wrong, so this is regarded as a particularly heinous multiple offense story. And again, since it's by the same author as the one who narrates the story of Sodom, it confirms that we're talking about multiple offense stories here. Same author, of course, is also responsible for the Genesis 2 text. And the Genesis 2 text makes quite clear that a sexual counterpart or complement to a man is a woman and a woman a man. And that's the only possible sexual counterpart or complement. So it's quite clear that the narrator would also indict homosexual practice generically. Then we have interpretations of the story, for example, in Ezekiel, which is Ezekiel making use of Levitical holiness code, which has Levitical prohibitions of homosexual practice. Every commentator of Ezekiel acknowledges that he knows this section of text in Leviticus, and he's reading the Sodom story in light of that in Ezekiel 16, 49 to 50, and indicting what happened, not only being haughty and not aiding the poor and needy, but also committing an abomination, Tovah, before me, and I removed them when I saw it, the text says. And this phrase, committed an abomination, is the exact same phrase used in Levitical prohibitions. And if that's true, then it's clear that he's reading the Sodom story in light of the Levitical prohibitions, which are absolute in their indictment of homosexual practice, not just coercive forms, but all forms of man-male intercourse. So that's an indication that Ezekiel understands this as, again, a compounding offense kind of story. The other interpretations, similarly in Jude and in 2 Peter, also make this point. Jude talks about that in the course of committing in the course of going after other flesh, that is, having sex with angels, though unawares, ended up committing sexual immorality, that is, man-male intercourse. They intended to commit sexual immorality, and they got more than they bargained for. They wound up having sex with other flesh, angels, which is an additional offense. But what would they be committing the sexual immorality? Well, in the context of looking at that story, we look at Josephus, Philo, and other Jews of the first century. The context for that is the same-sex intercourse. That is, Jews in the first century looked at this story and said, this isn't only rape, it's also homosexual practice, which we regard as a particularly severe offense. So again, it's a multiple offense kind of story. And then there's finally the story of the Levite at Gibeah, which makes it a similar kind of story, actually has similar wording and phrasing that we find in the Sodom story. And why that's important is that we know that the author of the narrator of those texts, of the Levite at Gibeah, which is found in Judges, also is the same narrator for a whole series of texts which indict homosexual cult prostitutes, largely because not just because of their idolatrous associations, not just because they may be in exchange of funds, but indict them because of their denial of their maleness. That is, these are the men who emasculate themselves, sometimes to the point of castration, sometimes short of that, in order to attract male sex partners. There are lots of names for them in the ancient Near East. They're known in lots of Mesopotamian texts.
About 30 seconds
here.
Where
they're also indicted primarily for emasculating themselves and ignoring the stamp of their gender that God has put in their being. So we know, again, why this author would have rejected those kinds of stories as well.
Dr. Robert Gagnon is Associate Professor of New Testament at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He's author of the book, The Bible and Homosexual Practice, Texts and Hermeneutics. You'll find a link to Dr. Gagnon's website under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Thank you very much, Dr. Gagnon.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to study the Easter hymn, Joy to the Heart. Pastor Will Whedon will be our guest. Then Monday, we're going to discuss baptism and courage. Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will be with us on Monday. Coming up in June, on the 14th to the 15th, right there in the middle of the month, right here in Collinsville, Illinois, we're going to have our very first Issues Etc. conference. It's called the Making the Case Conference. We're holding it for our listeners, a way of celebrating 5 years back on the air, and a way of giving our listeners what they've often asked for. They say, you guys need to have a conference. We said, well, we know we do, and we are going to have one this summer. It's called the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, featuring Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, Pastor Will Whedon, Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith, and others. June the 14th and the 15th, that's a Friday and a Saturday, right here in Collinsville, Illinois. You can register online. It's $100 per person, issuesetc.org. Look for the logo for the Making the Case Conference. You can call Craig right here in the office as well, 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. Ask Craig about the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and the 15th. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
When someone asks you, what do you believe as a Christian, how do you respond? Do you have a confession of faith? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled, I Believe. You can read it by subscribing to the Issues Etc. journal. Just look for the subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Mark Hemingway answers the question, why Lutheranism, with why not? Subscribe to the online Issues Etc. journal, issuesetc.org.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.